All right, great. So good morning, everybody. I'll be taking a slightly different approach. I won't be focusing so much on new results. I rather want to review approaches, modeling approaches that have been used in the past, and to give some examples of what we have learned from using those approaches, and maybe also give a little bit of a critical assessment of where their strengths are and where their limitations are, based on the input that we have received over the last few months and comments from many different people. And of course, this is a little bit of a personal view, so please feel free to interrupt me at any time and express your own view, which might not necessarily agree with my view. So I'll be talking a little bit about what we've learned from continuum approach and also from grain scale approaches for modeling particulate flows in aquatic environments. So just to get everybody on the same page, a common interest that many of us share is that of a turbidity current. Turbidity currents are typically generated in the following way. So we have a river flowing into the ocean. Think of the Mississippi River, for example. This river carries some sediment with it, and this sediment settles out on the continental shelf. And so over the years, it forms a layer of sediment at the bottom of the ocean here. And that layer of sediment, very similar to a layer of snow in the mountains, can go unstable. And so essentially, we form now an underwater avalanche, somewhat equivalent to a powder snow avalanche. And these underwater avalanches then travel down the continental slope into the deep ocean. And these underwater avalanches are what we call turbidity currents. And these turbidity currents can be very large in scale. One of these turbidity currents can sometimes transport hundreds of cubic kilometers of sediment. They can travel a couple thousand kilometers along the bottom of the ocean. And they're very important from a couple of different points of view, both within the global sediment cycle. They are very important because they are the main ingredient in that cycle that pushes sediment from the coastal oceans into the deep ocean. But also from the point of view of hydrocarbon production, they're important because the sediments typically contain some organic matter. This organic matter then, when it's brought into the deep ocean and when it becomes embedded in the sedimentary rock, can turn into hydrocarbons. And so there's some interest in reconstructing where these big sediment deposits may have formed throughout history, so that we have an idea of where we might be able to find some oil and gas. So that's the background. And so we've been working over the last 10 years or so towards modeling these flows from the point of view of the dilute limit. So we're looking at relatively small volume fractions of the particles on the order of 1% or less. Under those conditions, the particle radius is typically much less than the particle separation, so that we can neglect the direct interaction among particles, such as collisions. We also have limited ourselves to small particles with negligible inertia, so that we can assume these particles primarily follow along with the fluid motion, plus they have a superimposed settling velocity. So based on these assumptions, diluteness and small particles without inertia, we can then derive a set of governing equations that looks like this. We can neglect the effects of the particles on the continuity equation of the fluid because the volume fraction is very small. And so as a result, the coupling between fluid and particle motion primarily occurs through the momentum equation, not through the continuity equation. So we essentially assume that the particles, the sediment, modifies the density locally of the fluid, and in that way then allows gravitational forces to drive the flow. And then, of course, we need to make some assumptions about how the particles follow the fluid motion. And as I said, we assume negligible inertia so that particles follow the fluid motion with a superimposed settling velocity. So in terms of the Stokes number that has been discussed a lot over the last few weeks, we assume essentially a zero Stokes number limit. So this is then what I call the single fluid approach. So we model the whole suspension as a single fluid with this continuity equation for the fluid velocity, so no influence of the particles here. Then our typical Navier-Stokes equation with this gravitational term now that drives the flow. And so here C is the local sediment concentration. And so variations in C allow for different gravitational force strength, and that's what will set the flow into motion. And then we have a convection diffusion equation for the particle concentration field, where we assume that the particles follow the fluid motion, plus they have a superimposed settling velocity. So this is a single fluid model, if you want to call it, that gives rise to very few parameters, very few dimensionless parameters, a Reynolds number formed with a buoyancy velocity, a Schmidt number, which is not all that influential, it just is a dimensionless diffusion coefficient here, and a dimensionless particle settling velocity, which can be quite important. So let me show you a simple, well, not simple, but a nice simulation that Mohammed did. I don't know if Mohammed is in the audience here. Oh, there he is, okay. So if you want to discuss with him that simulation, feel free to do so over the next few days. So this is the so-called lock exchange configuration. So think of this as essentially an extended tank, like an aquarium, which we initially divide into two compartments. So we have here the fluid with a suspended sediment. And then here we have the clear fluid. And then at time t equals zero, we pull out this dividing wall here. And now gravity, of course, acts more strongly on this suspension here because it's denser than on this clear fluid. So it pulls the suspension down. And then we obtain a gravity current propagating along the bottom wall here. And Mohammed built actually a very nice code that now allows us to look at the effects of bottom topography. And as a canonical example, we've looked at the case of a gravity current or turbidity current past a seamount, a local seamount. Just a couple of bits of information about Mohammed's code. So he uses second order central differencing for the viscous terms, a third order Eno scheme for the convective terms, third order time stepping, a projection method to enforce incompressibility. And these are massively parallel calculations based on the domain decomposition technique. We use PETSI, a software package by Argonne, to solve the systems of linear equations. And the code allows us to use non-uniform grids. And in order to account accurately for the effect of the complex bottom topography, Mohammed implemented an immersed boundary method, which allows us to look both at arbitrarily complex bottom topographies, and also it will allow us to look at time-dependent topographies. So let's say when bottom features get created or get destroyed by the flow, so they can be time-dependent. So let me show you the simulation that Mohammed did. So we have here the lock, and the suspension initially actually contains 50% coarse particles, 50% fine particles. Then here we have the local seamount so that we can study the interaction of the current with this local seamount. We will look at this flow in terms of concentration contours of particle concentration. So you see the current evolving. You see this lobe and cleft instability evolving even before the interaction with this local seamount. And then you see how this local seamount creates a very strong three-dimensional evolution of the flow, very strong turbulent structures. Down here, we see the time-dependent deposit field. Now let's look at the difference between the fine particles and the coarse particles. So the fine particles settle out much more slowly than the coarse particles. And so the coarse particles, the volume fraction suspended in the fluid, decreases much more rapidly than for the fine particles. We can also color code the fine particles and the coarse particles depending on where they started from in the lock region, in order to see how well are these particle sizes being mixed. We see very thorough mixing for the fine sediment, not quite such thorough mixing for the coarse sediment, where we see here predominantly red color and so on. So they're more preferred locations for sedimenting out for those. This is a top view. Again, it shows a very thorough mixing for the fine particles, not such thorough mixing for the coarse particles. So we can then also study the flow field in some more detail. Well, first of all, we can look at the influence of this bottom topography on the vortical structures. So here we use what is called a Q criterion to visualize vortices. And we can see how this interaction with this local seamount tends to create a lot of vorticity, which then enhances turbulence, enhances the mixing in the flow, and leads to a much more pronounced three-dimensional evolution of the flow. And we can contrast the case over the flat bottom with the case over the local seamount. And so we can look at the influence of the local seamount on the deposit profiles and so on. So we can learn certain things from these calculations that might help us develop a sense of how these turbidity currents function and what the dominant mechanisms are. Now the question is, of course, how well do these simulations reflect reality? And what I should mention is that this simulation was a simulation for a Reynolds number of 2,000, which corresponds to a laboratory scale flow. And so we can compare that with laboratory scale experiments. Here we show an experiment by the group of Stuart Diel at Cambridge. This was for flow over a flat bottom, and we compare the simulation results with the experimental results here for the deposit profiles at three different times, and we see that the agreement is fairly reasonable regarding the prediction of the runout length, regarding the prediction of this local maximum here. Of course, we cannot expect to reproduce all the individual fluctuations quite accurately. So there are certain things that we can learn from these simulations, and we can now look at other configurations that allow us to study the influence of complex topography. Here we see a turbidity current coming down a submarine canyon. We see it spilling over the levees on the sides of the canyon in a process that is called flow stripping and so on. So these kinds of things we can simulate now based on this continuum modeling approach. Another example where this continuum modeling approach works well is when it comes to simulating the settling of particles from the river plumes. So typically, the situation that we encounter in a river plume is the following. We have a river carrying fairly dilute sediment flowing into the ocean. And typically, the combination of fresh water and sediment from the river is somewhat less dense than the combination of water and salt in the ocean. And as a result, most of the time, the river will flow, then the river plume will be at the top of the ocean. So that locally here, then, we have a configuration of fresh water and particles above salt water. And so this is the situation that we're now interested in. We want to see how do mixing processes, perhaps instabilities and so on, develop in this region here where we have fresh water and particles above salt water. And there are some very interesting dynamics in that region. Well, there's first of all the effect that you have particles settling through the interface. So you might very well generate a little bit of an overhang here in the density profile because you generate a layer here now at the top of the salt water that has both salt and particles. But there's also another effect that's very important, and that's the effect of double diffusion. And this is something that David Hoyal, for example, has looked at. So let me just introduce the main idea. The main idea is the following. So we have here the fresh water and particles. Particles diffuse effectively very slowly. Here we have fresh water and salt. Salt diffuses more rapidly. So that's the key difference. Particles diffuse slowly. Salt diffuses more rapidly. So let's see now, let's impose a small perturbation. Let's bring one fluid element from up here down to here. What happens to that fluid element? Well, because particles diffuse very slowly, these particles will stay in the fluid element. They will not strongly diffuse out. At the same time, the salinity diffuses more rapidly. So we have a lot of diffusion of salinity inwards into this fluid element of fresh water and particles. So that means very soon now we'll have a situation where we have here effectively salt water and particles surrounded by pure salt water. And so that means that this fluid element will now become denser than its environment, and it will keep sinking even though the nominal density distribution was such that we had light fluid on top of heavy fluid. So this will keep sinking. So that's the basic idea behind double diffusive sedimentation. And these are some nice simulations that my former PhD student Peter Burns carried out, two and three dimensional simulations. So he's looking exactly at this configuration up here, fresh water and salt, fresh water and sediment above salt. And he initially perturbs the flow field randomly at the interface. And you can see now how this double diffusive instability leads to the formation of these fingers, downward propagating fingers that contain both salt and particles, and upward propagating fingers that contain neither salt nor particles. This is the sediment field. This is the salinity field. And you can see the concentration gradients in the sediment field are much more pronounced because the effective diffusion coefficient is much less, whereas in the salinity field, the concentration gradients are more washed out. So we can let this develop. And the key observation here is that this double diffusive instability leads to a much more rapid settling of particles than Stokes settling alone. And that's an important observation, I believe, because typically, I think, many oceanographic models assume that particles will settle with a Stokes settling velocity. But here we saw that the settling velocity can be about 25 times larger than the Stokes settling velocity. So that might very well tell us some important things about how quickly particles can settle out of a river plume and so on. These are now 3D simulations of the same phenomenon. And you can see here the development of these upward and downward plumes, both in the sediment field and in the salinity field.
Is that isometric? Looks like they're going down faster than they're going up.
Yes, there are some asymmetries there, depending on the ratio of the diffusion coefficients, depending on the relative loading with salinity and particles, so the density loading. So yes, it's definitely asymmetric. Yes. Yeah, here you can see a crosscut now at the interface. And we see these plumes developing more quickly and more strongly in the sediment field, not so strongly in the salinity field. So this is a crosscut a little bit below the initial interface. The other one is above the interface. Here we're looking at the interfacial region from above and from below, and we can see these many plumes forming, which are similar, but still there are some differences in scale. So we've learned quite a bit from these kinds of simulations about those mechanisms, double diffusive sedimentation. So if we think about what can we learn from such DNS simulations, so a so-called single fluid model, and what are perhaps the challenges? Well, so I think among the strength of these types of simulations is that they can accurately reproduce continuum scale physics. They provide very detailed information on such quantities as mixing, dissipation, and so on. And they require really only a minimum of empirical model assumptions. At the same time, there are challenges still that keep us from doing DNS simulations for any kind of application that we're interested in. They are computationally very expensive. They are limited to small Reynolds numbers and laboratory scale currents. As I mentioned in the beginning, they're limited to dilute depositional currents with small particles without inertia. And it's not quite so straightforward to incorporate erosion into these simulations or bed load transport. And that's something where we'll probably hear more from Mike Glinsky later in the week about how to capture erosion and so on correctly. There are no direct particle-particle interactions, so no collisions in these simulations. As a result, there's very limited capability of these simulations to reproduce correct size segregation effects. In a way, the only difference between large particles and small particles are the differences in their settling velocities. But segregation mechanisms that rely, for example, on collisions among particles are not being captured by this approach. Also, this approach has not incorporated yet hindered settling. There's no concentration-dependent rheology, such as increase in viscosity as a result of particle concentration, and so on. So these are still challenges that will require further work on the DNS simulation approach. And so with regard to these points here, there are still limitations of this approach. I'll talk about some ongoing work regarding these issues in a minute. An alternative approach relies on so-called two-fluid models. So that's where we look at the particle phase and the fluid phase separately with a different set of equations. But in that case, we need so-called coupling terms that tell us something about the momentum exchange between the two different phases. And these coupling terms are, again, difficult to derive from first principles. So they frequently require some empirical closures. And as a result, maybe there's, with regard to these two fluid models, there's perhaps a sense right now that those two fluid models, you can't get around them when you want to do certain very applied problems. But as a result, it's perhaps somewhat limited as to what we can learn about fundamental physics from these kinds of models. And so as a result, over the last 3 months in the GeoFlows program, we did not have too many presentations that addressed the two fluid models. So one question that came up was, why can't we do DNS simulations at very large Reynolds numbers, such as 10 to the 9? Well, for that, it's necessary to keep in mind that the Reynolds number effectively is a measure of the ratio of the largest, the so-called integral length scales of the flow, to the smallest length scales. And so if we want to do a DNS simulation, then what we need to do, we need to, on one hand, have a grid that's fine enough to capture the smallest flow scales, but at the same time, we need to have an overall computational domain that's large enough to capture the largest flow scales. And so turbulence theory tells us that this ratio of the largest scales to the smallest scales increases as Reynolds number to the 3/4. So that means as our Reynolds number becomes larger, we need to have more and more grid points because the number of grid points is proportional to this ratio. So that means the number of grid points in each direction scales as Reynolds number to the 3/4. And so for a three-dimensional simulation, that means we have a ratio of the grid points now scaling with Reynolds number to the 9/4. In addition, a typical CFD code also requires that the time step is proportional to delta x. So that means that the overall computational effort typically goes like Reynolds number to the 3rd. And so if you keep in mind that the DNS simulation that I showed that Mohammed had carried out was for a Reynolds number order 10 to the 3, and that some of our large-scale field applications are Reynolds numbers 10 to the 9. So that would mean that the computational effort to conduct a DNS at field scale would be about 10 to the 18 times the simulation effort that Mohammed has done. And so as a result, we can not do that. The way to get around that is through turbulence modeling. Yes, okay, good. Turbulence modeling. There are different approaches. There are RANS approaches. There are LES approaches. And in particular, Sentiel, who is also here in the audience, has worked on extending our simulation approach to LES models. So I'll compare here a DNS model with an LES model. for the same configuration. You can see here that the LES simulation shows a lot more small-scale structure. It shows a larger front velocity, and it will also lead to different bottom shear stress, so different erosion dynamics. Another way in which we are working on upscaling these kinds of approaches is by coupling them, for example, with ocean models, regional ocean models, such as ROMs, through a nested grid approach, where at the smaller scales, we might be able to use RANS or LES simulations, and then couple that to larger scale ocean models in order to be able to account for a number of larger scale dynamics. One thing that I mentioned was the difficulty to include erosion and resuspension. So far, with this code, we've done that mostly on the basis of an empirical correlation by Garcia and Parker that provides us with an erosion function as a result of bottom wall shear stress, settling velocity, and particle Reynolds number. And that has led to some limited progress. And I won't go into detail because I'm sure Mike will talk more about that. But let me just summarize that this is still somewhat empirical, not based on first principles. So as a result, we have recently worked on grain scale simulations. And again, I just want to show a couple of different things. So this is now a sediment bed where we simulate the flow around each particle. Here we have pure fluid above, and we set into motion the wall at the top here, and so then the shear will eventually set the particle bed into motion. So this is a situation where we have a Shields number that's very close to the critical value, so there's no strong tendency for erosion to occur, but we'll see that as soon as the effect of the initial conditions is forgotten, that we get some realistic dynamics that still include some bed load transport.
What's the Reynolds number in the wet flow?
I think it was about 20 here, so it's not too large. So here we can see that there's still some bed load transport, so some particles are rolling and sliding along the top, but there's no strong erosion. Let me show you by comparison a simulation where the Shields number is about 5 times higher, and here we'll see that there's a much stronger erosion, so that lifting of particles into the flow is much stronger. The sediment bed moves around. Oh, these colors indicate instantaneous force chains where particles are colliding with each other. I think here we had about 20 particle diameter. The last layer is essentially glued to the bottom, so the last layer doesn't move. It's way below here. And so from these simulations, we can now try to extract some continuum properties. So this, again, shows the simulation. Here we show the average velocity, averaged in the streamwise direction, the average velocity of the fluid and of the particles. And we now see that some kind of an equilibrium state evolves. And this equilibrium state then allows us to make the argument, well, the shear stress has to be constant at any given value of y. And so we can now, from the given velocity profile, du dy, we can go back and extract an effective viscosity. And so that's what we've done here. So we've extracted an effective viscosity as a function of y. And we can see that this effective viscosity can be 45 times larger than the molecular viscosity as a result of the particle loading. So in summary, well, I won't go into this. In summary, these grain scale simulations do offer some advantages. They accurately capture the dynamics of individual grains. They provide fairly detailed interactions. They can clarify mechanisms governing size segregation. They allow us to attract some, to extract some large scale properties such as viscosity, so that we can perhaps upscale on those. We can use these simulations. I'll just take one or two more minutes. Yeah. We can use these simulations to perhaps study the erosion of compacted versus non-compacted sand. And another important question is, we can use them to study the interaction between the flow inside the sediment bed and above the sediment bed. At the same time, again, there are some challenges and questions. So again, computationally, these are quite expensive. They're currently limited perhaps to systems of order 1,000 particles. And there's also the question of what can we really learn by looking at a few grains, perhaps in the real world, large-scale dynamics of big chunks of sediment that get extracted all of a sudden simultaneously might be much more important than dynamics of individual grains. So the summary, we've made some progress based on these continuum flow simulations, some progress based on grain scale simulations. Each of them can teach us something, but there's still lots of open questions. So the question is, where do we go from here? And I feel that it's important to look at closing the gap between grain scale simulations and lab scale simulations. So to look at mesoscale effects so that we can upscale these grain scale simulations. In the same way, we need to upscale the laboratory scale simulations to field scales through LES and RANS modeling. We need to have a much better understanding based on first principles of the interactions between current and bed, including erosion, bed load transport, coupling between the flow above the bed and inside the bed, and so on. We need to have better understanding of the influence of higher concentrations, such as particle collisions, hindered settling, rheology, and so on. And in my opinion, there's no one silver bullet, no one magic tool that would allow us to make progress on all of this without anything else. So I think it really requires a coordinated effort based on grain scale simulations, on mesoscale, laboratory scale, field scale observations, laboratory measurements, and also field scale observations. So I think we really need an integrated approach using all of those tools. And perhaps from that point of view, it would be useful to introduce some test cases that can then be analyzed based on all these different tools. Okay, sorry for going over time a little bit. Thank you.
Questions and discussions. First question.
Well, a very interesting talk. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I have two questions. The first one is, in the log exchange configuration simulation you showed, what's the role, how do you treat the lateral boundary condition?
The lateral boundary conditions are being treated as a slip walls.
Okay. And does that have any influence on the final result? Do you try to having
well, if you were to use no slip walls, yes, then it certainly would have an effect. If you use periodic boundary conditions in the lateral direction, then it probably wouldn't have much of an effect. But certainly between slip walls and no slip walls, there is an effect because you don't generate the lateral boundary layers with the slip walls.
And the second question is regarding the problem of the river flowing to the ocean.
Right.
What's your expectation for any, do you expect any gradient in temperature between the two flows at the flow interface?
That's of course also something that can happen in addition.
Your simulation should be a triple diffusive.
That's right. So in addition to sediment being there and salinity, we can also have temperature with again a different diffusion coefficient. So that can much more complicate the process even, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Second question.
Can you give us some specifics of the particle simulations at the end? Because how was it done? What is the particle interaction laws?
Yeah, so here we had a simulation. It's similar to an immersed boundary code that resolves the flow around each particle. It's not exactly that. And we assume that we have collisions among the particles with a certain restitution coefficient. We also have frictional forces among the particles in the tangential direction. I guess those are the basic.
Lubrication comes out automatically.
Sorry, what?
The lubrication force emerges.
It's not accounted for explicitly as particles move towards each other. We essentially use some kind of a spring, a damped spring law in order to account for their interaction. Yeah.
Second question. another question. But first, your neighbor, I think, goes first.
Hi. Following up on in that section,
yes.
How does the viscosity that you estimated compare with these particles that are neutrally buoyant at the same volume fractions and so on? How do you?
We really haven't gone into that in any detail. That's what Edward is going to do, who is sitting there next to you. So these were just some very preliminary simulations. They were in 2D. Edward is now building the 3D code, and I assume that the difference between 2D and 3D will be substantial. And then we can look at all those questions.
And you expect there to be differences?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in the bed load simulations that there's quite a broad layer from the inner where particles are moving.
Yes.
And we notice in the lab when we do experiments on bed load that generally the interface is very small. It's only the first layer or maybe one or two particle diameters that's moving.
Yes.
But when we did experiments with a single grain size of spheres, you do in fact get this broad layer of transport. And I wonder if you could run the same simulations with even like a bidispersed grain mixture. I would imagine that would change the bed load dynamics.
That's again something that Edward is working on. So you're absolutely right. I mean, these simulations were somewhat artificial in that they were monodispersed. Also, the initial configuration of the bed, as you may have seen, was very regular. All the particles were lined up exactly. And so that, of course, contributes to the gliding of particle layers past each other. Yes, if we start with a more random initial configuration of the bed and with certainly with particles of different sizes, then I assume the behavior will be somewhat different. Yes, good point. Mm-hmm.
Okay, next questions here.
So you talked a lot about trying to really unravel some of the difficult physics puzzles, for instance, with the erosion or this generation of electricity in these flows. And there's a different research program that kind of goes on along behind that, which is, I mean, if you think about a submarine flow on tens of kilometers scale, we're never going to be able to model all of that physics. And so there's also an element of trying to figure out what's when you upscale, what's really important, what you have to keep in. And how can you effectively build a hierarchy of phenomenological theories on higher and higher scales? Can you just comment about the progress in that research program? And I'd be kind of interested in your views on that.
Yes. Well, I agree with you. That's the crucial question if we want to go to field scale applications. So my point of view is that we need to try to understand what's happening at the microscale in order to then be able to upscale. One first element of progress, if that's what you want to call it, was to extract an effective viscosity out of these grain scale simulations, which would perhaps allow us to specify a concentration-dependent viscosity profile near the sediment bed in a large-scale simulation. So these are the kinds of things that we hope to extract. In the same way, we hope to extract relationships between the flow above the bed and effective erosion rates, which we can then feed into the large-scale simulations. So yes, you're absolutely right. These kinds of upscaling questions need to be addressed, and we hope that we can address them through the physical understanding that we gain from the grain-scale simulations.
You could have analyzed those data also in terms of particular description, but you didn't do it. Why is there a reason for that?
Why I didn't do any
tool? You could have analyzed data in terms of the two fluid model instead of an effective viscosity.
Yes. We want to instead of using a two fluid model, which again involves a number of empirical assumptions, we want to go as close to first principles as we can in order to understand the physics behind that.
It's no different whether you analyze it in a two-fluid picture or in a one-fluid picture in terms of empirical. I mean, if you analyze your data, which are grain scale, there is nothing empirical about that.
Okay, well, perhaps the kind of two-fluid models that you're talking about, I'm not so familiar with, so I'd like to talk to you more about that. That's true. I mean, usually the larger the Shields number is, so the more particles become eroded into the flow field, the larger an effective slip velocity we get, and so on. So you're right, there will be slip velocities. Mm-hmm.
So now,
what was your turn? That you showed, I think, in the case of the obstacle when you compared it to experiment, that the experiment did not show what looked like some type of wave-like instability that was developing sort of on the back side of the deposition. Can you sort of comment on what maybe, you know, what type, there may be some extra damping or something, the experiment that would have destroyed that? Or?
So which simulations and
experiments? You actually show, I'm not sure which one, but you're showing a profile, and on your simulations there were sort of a downstream oscillation deposition profile.
Yes. So, well, I mean, there are some differences, of course. In the simulations, there was no feedback of the bottom topography that might be evolving as a result of deposition onto the flow. So perhaps if we had that kind of a feedback in there, that might allow us to get more of these oscillations.
Okay. Yeah. All right, two questions, Eckhart. Experimental. I was wondering, are there actually good experimental results on polydispersed turbidity currents where you can see where the light and heavy particles settle out? The experiment of Dalil you showed, I wasn't sure if that was monodispersed.
I think there are some experiments available for some basic configurations, polydispersed flows. Mama, do you want to comment more on that?
I think Gladstone's group they have done some nice polydispersed.
Probably Gladstone, yeah.
And I think Cuba also did a couple of good both shallow water type and also experiments. And probably you know better.
Well, I think there are probably nine dozen anybody.
Yeah. So there are some results available, but I don't think there are any detailed simulations available.
Yeah. Oh, the other question I had was, when you do those lock exchange experiments, often many people, you've got to keep all the sediments in suspension, so it's not actually a still initial velocity distribution. So I was wondering if that makes a big difference.
It does make a difference, yes. We did do some simulations where we started the lock fluid not from rest, but from some initial turbulent field, and that means you already have a lot of vorticity in there from the very beginning. That vorticity can then be stretched as soon as you pull out the dividing wall. And so that leads right away to stronger turbulence evolution and so on. So yes, there is an effect with that as well. Mm-hmm.
Then we have two questions, but there was, I think, Jasper was first. Yeah,
thanks for a very interesting talk. I love the movies.
Thanks.
So the double diffusivity problem that you showed, is that applicable, for instance, to like normal river mixing into oceans? Is this taken into account, for instance, in climate models?
Is it applicable to what?
To rivers flowing into oceans.
Yeah, that's the main thing that we have in mind, that you have fresh water and sediment
right.
Flowing above salt water.
Right.
And so you have these two different scalars, the sediment concentration, the salt concentration,
right.
And because they have different effective diffusion coefficients, that's what sets up this dynamics. You know.
And so is that normally accounted for, like in regional climate models or global climate models?
As far as I know, it's not accounted for.
Okay, because it's a rather big effect.
Right, that's right. As I mentioned, in these simulations here, we found that the effective settling velocity as a result of double diffusive sedimentation was a factor 25 bigger than the Stokes settling velocity.
Right, and so because you had a lot of sediment in these simulations, is that, I assume that's more than you get in normal rivers, is it? Like how
no, it was not a particularly large amount of sediment. In rivers, you actually can get situations where the amount of sediment loading can be larger than the amount of salinity, in which case the river water dips down below the ocean water right away. But in our cases, we were limited to the situation where we had relatively small sediment loadings.
Yes. In the lock exchange system, all the mass comes from above. And it comes down to maybe a minimal amount of erosion. But there are phenomena where there's a massive injection of sediment at the head of the current, such as powder snow avalanches.
Right.
Do you have any plans to adapt your simulations to those rather extreme events where erosion is far exceeds what the shield's correlation could
do? Well, I mean, essentially, that's what we're, in some sense, it's what we're trying to do, because we release this sediment, you know, instantaneously in the lock exchange configuration. So that starts the flow. But of course, we're in a very different parameter regime regarding particle density and fluid density. I think the dynamics of avalanches are strongly affected by the very high density ratio between particles and fluid, which is order 1,000, whereas here is maybe order 2. And so that might account for a big difference. I mean, I'm not sure if I understand your question correctly, but maybe we can talk about it afterwards.
Again, maybe I have another question concerning the turbidity flows. You don't take into account momentum transfer between the fluid and the particles, in the sense that the particles can take out momentum of fluid.
Yes, they do. They do. So, for example, when the particles settle, that effectively represents momentum transfer from the particle to the fluid and so on.
So it's, is the fluid slow down when it picks up particles from the bed, or is it?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in the simulations that I showed here, we didn't have any erosion in there. It was only depositional. But the fluid, yeah. So, you know, within the Businesque approximation, I think that wouldn't be accounted for. It's only really the vertical momentum exchange, not the horizontal momentum exchange.
And that's what the two fluids model try to do with the closure space device. I mean, leaving that factor out is, of course, also.
And also, I would say there could be drag on the fluid associated with the settling.
Certainly, certainly.
Okay, yes. But at the moment, that's not included.
Right. Yeah.
What are the major couplings in the two fluid problem, Eckert? Is it mainly collisional couplings between the two constituents, or are there other? What are the other couplings between the equations?
Well, I'm really not an expert on that, so I'm not sure if I can answer that question very well. But essentially, there you assume that one phase is the particulate phase, the other phase is the continuum phase, mm-hmm. and so you need to have exchange terms between the momentum equations for each of those. And I think those are the ones that are tough to model. Perhaps detailed simulations, maybe even grain scale simulations can help us come up with expressions that can be used to close those problems. Yes, that's not something that I can talk much about.
I wonder if there are any analogies to the plasma physics community. They're a community that works a lot with two fluid flows and has worked very hard on very strongly coupled flows.
Okay.
These should actually be easier systems because the coupling is probably not as long range. You don't have magnetic fields threading through the fluid.
Well, I'd be happy to learn more about that.
Yeah. There might be progress.
Yeah.
You want to say something?
Oh, no. The freshman's time.